Chapachitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 October 12, 2015, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 6, Creation of the Universal Form, Text 34. Ete varna swadharmena.
Ete varna swadharmena.
Yajanti swagurum hari.
Yajanti swagurum hari.
Shradayatma vishudhyartham.
Shradayatma vishudhyartham.
Yajjata sahavrittivi. Ete.
Ete. Ete.
All these.
All these.
All these.
Varnaha.
Varnaha.
Orders of society.
Orders of society.
Swadharmena.
Swadharmena.
By one's own occupational duties.
By one's own occupational duties.
Yajanti.
Yajanti.
Worship.
Worship.
Swagurum.
Swagurum.
With the spiritual master.
With the spiritual master.
Harim.
Harim.
The supreme personality of Godhead.
The supreme personality of Godhead.
Shraddhaya.
Shraddhaya.
With faith and devotion.
With faith and devotion.
Atma.
Atma.
Self.
Self.
Vishuddhi artam. For purifying.
For purifying.
Yat.
Yat.
From whom?
From whom?
Jataha.
Jataha.
Born.
Born.
Saha.
Saha.
Along with.
Along with.
Vritti bihi.
Vritti bihi.
Occupational duty.
Occupational.
Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. All these different social divisions are born with their occupational duties and living conditions from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Thus, for unconditional life and self-realization, one has to worship the Supreme Lord under the direction of the Spiritual Master. Purport. Since they are born from different parts of the body of the Supreme Lord in His gigantic form, all living entities in all parts of the entire universe are supposed to be eternal servitors of the Supreme Body. Every part of our own body, such as the mouth, hands, thighs, and legs, is meant to render service to the whole. That is their constitutional position. In subhuman life, the living entities are not conscious of this constitutional position, but in the human form of life, they are supposed to know this through the system of the varnas, the social orders. As above mentioned, the Brahmana is the spiritual master of all the orders of society, and thus Brahminical culture, culminating in the transcendental service of the Lord, is the basic principle for purifying the soul. In conditioned life, the soul is under the impression that he can become the Lord of the universe, and the last point of this misconception is to think oneself the Supreme. The foolish conditioned soul does not take into account that the Supreme cannot be conditioned by Maya or illusion. If the Supreme were to become conditioned by illusion, where would be his supremacy? In that case, Maya or illusion would be the supreme. Therefore, because the living entities are conditioned, they cannot be supreme. The actual position of the conditioned soul is explained in this verse. All the conditioned souls are impure due to contact with the material energy in three modes of nature. Therefore, it is necessary that they purify themselves under the guidance of the bona fide spiritual master, who not only is a Brahmana by qualification, but must also be a Vaishnava. The only self-purifying process mentioned herein is to worship the Lord under the recognized method, under the guidance of the bona fide spiritual master. That is the natural way of purification, and no other method is recommended as bona fide. The other methods of purification may be helpful to come to this stage of life, but ultimately one has to come to this last point before he attains actual perfection. Bhagavad Gita 7.19 confirms this truth as follows. Bahunam janmanam mante gyanavam mam prapadyate vasudevam sarvamiti samahatma sudura labaha. Ete varnas vadarmena yajanti swagurum harim shradhayatma visudartam yajjata sahavritti bi. All these different social divisions are born with their occupational duties and living conditions from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Thus, for unconditional life and self-realization, one has to worship the Supreme Lord under the direction of the spiritual master. Srila Prabhupada was once asked by a non-devotee, a professor, I think. Maybe it was a reporter, but I think it was a professor, that if you only had to pick one verse to encapsulate your message, what it would be. And Prabhupada chose the Bhagavatam verse that says, occupational duties are not for sense gratification, but therefore satisfying the Lord. So we find ourselves in this life, you know, born into a body, into a family. We don't know how we got here, what we're doing here. And we very quickly learn that in order to live in this world, we have to have some livelihood to be alive. We have to have some occupational duty. So at first our parents are just maintaining us. When we're little tiny children, we're not expected to do anything. You know, when we're infants or even when we're 1 or 2 years old, we're not expected to do anything except play and be maintained. But very, very quickly we're expected to do some household chores, at least to put our toys away. And after a while we're expected to go to school and get an education. We're expected to be doing some occupational duty. And then we're expected to have a source of income. And the parents say, you know, we're not going to maintain you forever. You have to have your own job. You have to have your own income. You have to have your livelihood. And Krishna tells Arjuna this, that nobody can live without some sort of work. So although wealth is all around us, we have to do something to collect that wealth. It doesn't just come to us automatically. I mean, even in former ages, even in Satya Yuga, in the beginning of Satya Yuga, where there were no varnas, and simply the earth was producing crops automatically, we have a little bit of that idea here in Hawaii. Just like out in the woods behind our house, there was this avocado tree, and one huge branch fell down with at least 100 avocados on it. And we had so many avocados, we were distributing them to everybody we could think of, and still we had this surfeit of avocados to eat. And the island is like that. There's just food-bearing trees and plants everywhere. So one could factually live without agriculture. But still, we had to collect the avocados or they would have rotted on the ground. We had to collect them. We had to keep them somewhere. We had to cut them open and so forth. There's some endeavor needed. Right, when we're a newborn infant, I suppose our only endeavor is to cry, and the mother simply feeds. But very soon there's some endeavor needed. So the conditioned soul just thinks, well, this world doesn't belong to anyone. I'm just somehow here, and you know, somehow or other there's food here, and I have to work, and I'm the doer, and I'm the one who creates my livelihood. In whatever way I do it, I'm the creator of my livelihood. I work hard. I use my intelligence. I use my education. I use my creativity. I use my network of friends. Or maybe I use my scheming and my cheating, whatever. I use something as I am the doer. Ahankara vimudhatma kartaham iti manite. I am the doer, and I am maintaining myself by my own energy. So Prabhupada talks about this as being the mentality of the animals. And by that qualification, I would think we can say that a large number of the human beings on the planet today are animals. And indeed, the modern education system in the secular countries is like that. You know, you are great, you are wonderful, you are maintaining yourself by your own potency. So higher than that, what human life is meant for is really something quite different. it's meant for, as explained here, Vishuddhi Artham. Artha means a goal. And the goal is Vishuddhi Artham. Shuddha is pure. The goal is to become pure. The goal is to see things as they are. Unfortunately, just to work to maintain the body and mind, extended family, the society, the poor, and so forth, and try to have more and more amenities for the body and mind, doesn't tell us what the truth is. It doesn't take us out, as Prabhupada's saying, out of the conditional position. The conditional position is my very limited bodily happiness is dependent on my conditions. It's dependent on how much money I can make. It's dependent on how many friends I have. It depends on what people think of me. It's very conditional, and as soon as those conditions are changed, then I can't get happiness anymore. And no matter how hard I work, no matter how clever I am, I'm not in absolute control of those conditions. And one feels very disconnected. One feels very alone. Even within the family, one feels very alone. One's family members don't understand us. They don't always treat us the way that we would like to be treated. They don't always facilitate us. And we feel, in general, very alone. No matter how much we try to have our football teams and our cricket teams and our governments and our religious organizations, we feel very disconnected, alone, struggling, conditioned. We're buffeted around by the modes of material nature. So this is not the purpose. And interestingly enough, the occupational duties, the varna, this section of Bhagavatam deals with the varnas, can be a means. As Krishna also says in the end of the 18th chapter, they can be a means for understanding truth, for coming to purification. They're not simply a means to put food in the stomach and a shelter over the body and clothes on the body and music on your MP3 player. They're not just a means for that. They're really a means for seeing the truth, for being absorbed in truth. So how to do this? How to take the thing? And I think this principle is one of the most amazing, mysterious, and loving aspects of the Lord. How to take something which apparently is completely mundane and have it be the source of our purification. You know, there's a real idea, a very deep idea within many people that if one wants to become realized, if one wants to become purified, then one shouldn't be engaged in earning a livelihood in the world. One shouldn't be engaged in earning money. And there's some basis to that, in that the later ashrams of life, the vanaprastha sannyas ashrams, and even to a large extent the student ashram, the brahmachari ashram, are not engaged in earning a livelihood in the ordinary sense. They don't have any varna activities. So it may seem to us that the activities of varna are simply entangling. We should give them up as soon as possible. And there's certainly many members of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness and related organizations, people who think that way. They think, if I really want to become purified, if I really want to become spiritual, then I have to not have anything to maintain my livelihood. I can't work for money. I can't work for a livelihood. That's simply illusion, and it's simply my material desires. But here we find in the Bhagavatam and in the Bhagavad Gita that our livelihood itself, when done properly, can be a cause of our purification. The very thing, as Narada Muni tells Srila Vyasadeva, does not a thing when applied therapeutically cure a disease that is caused by that very same thing. So how can it be applied therapeutically? So we're going to look at the solution, and we've talked about the problem a little bit. We're going to look at the solution, and we're going to look specifically at the role of guru, which is mentioned in this verse. So the solution is to see our varna as part of the universal body. Now, this is a low level of solution. However, this is a solution that can be understood by any human being. One doesn't have to be very spiritually elevated. One doesn't have to be, any kind of super scholarly or intelligent person to understand this point. And in fact, the ecological movement, the whole environmentalist movement, is very much related to this point, that we're part of the universe. Now, they generally see it as just part of the earth, but we're really part of the universal body. And the Lord has this universal body, and we've been talking about this a lot recently because that's what the verses are about. But exactly like Prabhupada's saying, the organs of the body, all of our organs of our body are meant to serve the whole body. But that doesn't mean they don't have their own individual life. They do. You know, each cell in my heart, each cell in my intestines, in my skin, they all have their own individual life. They have their own eating, their own sleeping, their own reproduction, their own defending. They have their life. And in fact, I'm providing for their life, one could say, without even intending to. It's just, of course, they're provided for. And really, the little cells don't need to think about providing for their life. All they need to think about is doing their job in the whole body. And then they're naturally provided for. And a similar situation exists. There's so many mundane examples of similar situations. And we give these examples all the time. That if you work for a good company, now some companies are not good companies, but if you work for a good company, you don't have to think about your maintenance. You're not really working for your own maintenance. You can work for the good of the company, and the company naturally maintains you as a byproduct. You know, if you have a job that you really love and you're really inspired, and you're really inspired by the mission of the company, which is what everybody would like to have, that kind of a job, then you throw yourself into the company's mission, and if the company is good and righteous, then they naturally maintain you according to your needs. And this is what Prabhupada talked about, spiritual communism, from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. And if it's truly some organization that takes care of their people, which unfortunately in Kali Yuga we see this less and less and less, but there are organizations like that. There are companies like that where the heads of the company are just thinking about making the employees happy. And therefore, the employees can just think about making the company happy. The same should be true, again, in a family. Again, nowadays, there's so many what we call dysfunctional families. But the ideal is there, right? A father and mother, they're providing for the children, and the children simply serve the parents, and then they're taken care of. You know, or the wife is serving the husband, and he's earning the livelihood, and she's taken care of. And she doesn't need, you know, as in the Grihastha ashram, I wasn't even aware of the finances. It was very rare that I was aware of the finances. You know, I was just taken care of. Certainly when I was growing up, it was like that. So this is some kind of example. You know, we serve our country. Again, you know, these are ideal, but you serve your country, you pay the taxes, and the country provides you with what you need. You're given your utilities and your whatever, you know, the police force, everything that the country provides for you is just, you don't have to worry about it. You're just serving the whole. So this is the lowest level at which one's varna purifies one. And it means a subtle but significant shift in consciousness, that one is no longer working to maintain oneself at all. One is working for the satisfaction of the whole. And one's maintenance comes naturally as a byproduct. One doesn't worry about one's maintenance. The theme of not worrying about one's maintenance, not having anxiety about one's maintenance, runs throughout all of the scriptures. And that can only occur when one is thinking, my work is done as part of the universal body, as part of the functional aspect of the universal body. We've talked before that in sociology, this view of reality is called functionalism. So in order for the universal body to function, I have to do my role. And we have again in this verse, repeated throughout these verses, swadharmena, I have my particular role. You know, the newborn baby, in the newly conceived baby in the womb, is just one cell. It's only one cell. It doesn't have any differentiated functions. And rather quickly, relatively speaking, it starts differentiating into different organs, which is amazingly miraculous. But anyway, it starts differentiating into different organs. It starts being bones and heart and lung and brains and skin and eyes and ears. And then each has their functions. And we could say, perhaps, that one is better than the other, that the brain is more important than the stomach or something like that. But they're all important. Nobody wants to lose any of their organs. Nobody wants to lose any parts of their body. I was watching this thing about which of our fingers is the most important and the least important. But, you know, who wants to lose any of your fingers? And each has their role. And it's not that the heart should act like the stomach or the stomach should act like the brain. And when each does their role for the good of the whole body, then each part is also naturally taken care of. It's just what it is. And then each part has no anxiety. It's not that the cells in my heart have to have some anxiety about their own maintenance. So what is our role in the universe in terms of occupational duty? So that we've talked about before, we just mentioned it briefly today, that these roles are divided into four main categories in the Shastra. Certainly one could subdivide them many, many, many times over. But whether or not one's interest is in wisdom, one's interest is in caring for people, one's interest is in generating wealth, or one's interest is in the beauty and function of society. So depending on what one's interest is in, then that's the role that one plays in society. And then we have a very specific role. I mean, in addition, it's not mentioned here, but in addition, we also have a role according to our life cycle in terms of being a student, family person, retired, or preparing for death. But here is talking about how we maintain ourselves. So I find what is the thing that I love. And it's interesting to me that in the world, this concept of matching one's natural propensity to one's occupation is quite well known and widely propagated. There's so many tests of one's nature. There's, of course, the very famous Myers-Briggs test. But there's so many tests. What is your nature? What is your inclination? What do you love? And you take that love. What do they say? Where the world's greatest need meets your greatest joy. You take what you love. You take what fills you with life. Chaturvanya mayashastam gunakarma vibhagasaha. Tasyakartam apimam vidyakartam avayam. Guna karma. So guna, your dharma, your nature. And each of us has a particular nature. Even among everyone who's a Brahmin or everyone who's a Shudra, it goes down to individuality. There's so many different ways to be a Shudra, so many different ways to be a Brahmana. And it comes down to the fact that each of us has our unique contribution, and we have things we really like and we're really good at, and things that we really don't like and we're really not very good at. And in this way we find what is my place in this life, in the universal body, and then I work for the satisfaction of the Lord. I work for the satisfaction of the whole. I don't even really work for the satisfaction of the other individual organs. The heart's not really working for the satisfaction of the brain. The heart is working for the whole body. The finger's not working for the satisfaction of the other finger. The finger is working for the satisfaction of the whole body. And if we get this one point, our whole life becomes so much happier. I'm not working to satisfy the president or prime minister of my country. I am not working to satisfy my employer. I am not working to satisfy my professor. I'm not working to satisfy my husband, my wife, my children, my mother, my father. I'm not working to satisfy any of those people. I am working to satisfy the Lord. And if I satisfy the Lord, then everybody is satisfied. If the heart beats for the body and the body is healthy, then all the parts of the body are satisfied. So if everybody works for the satisfaction of the whole, then all the parts of the body are satisfied. Now we may say in our practical life, if I'm working to please Krishna, my wife may still be very angry with me. She may still divorce me. That may be. If some part of the body is diseased, then that part of the body is not receiving proper nourishment. And no matter how much I am working for the body, then that part of the body is not being nourished. So we cannot make everyone happy in that sense. I certainly cannot make another jiva happy directly. In fact, I cannot even make myself happy directly. I don't have that capacity. What to speak of making another living entity happy directly. But if I work for the service of the whole, at least I will be happy, and everybody who's properly connected will also be happy. And that's all I can do, and that's enough. So that's on the lowest level. And anybody can do that. Anybody can do that. Anybody can say, I am doing my occupation to serve the good of the whole. Now, of course, one can do this in a kind of impersonal way, just as the cosmos, as the universal body, or one can do this in a very personal way. And Prabhupada points out in these verses, he talks a lot about impersonalism in these verses, which is interesting because the verses themselves and the commentaries of the acharyas don't seem to deal with impersonalism. So one could wonder, why is he doing that? And it seems, from my understanding, that if one limits oneself just to the universal form, then one isn't getting that personal of an understanding. And one can think that purification is when I start identifying myself as the whole body. And of course, Prabhupada makes the point here, as he makes many times, that if I was the whole body, if I was the whole thing, I wouldn't be able to be illusioned. It just wouldn't work. Also, the idea of identifying ourselves with the whole body is our problem in the first place. I think instead of I'm a part of the whole and I have to serve the whole, then I think I am the whole. I am everything. I am the center. So thinking that I am the center in a quasi-spiritual way is not going to solve my problem. It may, as Prabhupada say, there may be other processes of purification that can bring you to the point of bhakti. If one thinks I am identical to the whole in quality and one is focused on impersonal realization in that sense, which is a lot better than materialistic consciousness, undoubtedly. But still, it doesn't really get you to the ultimate reality. So higher even than seeing our occupation as part of the universal body, going beyond that, is seeing, well, who am I really? Because my swadharma, my swabhava, my guna in this world, it's not me really. It's not my ultimate dharma, savaipum sam paro dharma. Yato bhakti hoksaje hoitukiya pritiyata yad yatma supersedati. So if I just simply use my occupation in the Lord's service, then I'll have a happy life and proper sense gratification and so forth. But to really come to ultimate purification, I have to go beyond that to I'm not this body at all. And my dharma and my nature are very different. My dharma and my nature is not that of a kshatriya or a shudra or, you know, male or female or this or that. My dharma and my nature is in relationship with the Lord. Now, interestingly enough, just like on the material platform, if I want to understand my dharma and my nature, I have to understand it in relation to the whole in order for it to be perfect. So in other words, if I just say, well, I really like to work with people, I really like to help people, I really like to, you know, to manage large amounts of people, and so let me find an occupation that fulfills that, that's not going to be enough. I have to see it in relationship to the whole. How am I going to use that nature in such a way to benefit everyone? You know, people may at least think, well, I'll benefit my city, I'll benefit my country, I'll benefit the planet. But one to think I'll benefit the Lord, who has given me all these things and who is the universal body. And otherwise, it's not perfect. Just to be in an occupation, just to have one's livelihood in a way that suits one's nature, will not give one satisfaction. Even for gross materialistic atheists, it will not. There has to be a higher service involved. So in a similar way, understanding our ultimate nature, I am spirit soul, aham brahmasmi, na jayate miyate va kadachin. I'm not born, I don't die, I can't be damaged. I am nothing to do with this world. I am simply the witness. I am just the observer. I am a spiritual, eternal being who never had no beginning and no end. Just to understand that is not enough. even if one understands something of one's nature, it's got to be in relationship to the whole. Our ultimate nature is in relationship to the whole. You know, I am Krishna's servant. I am Krishna's friend. I am Krishna's beloved. I am Krishna's teacher. I am Krishna's father. So what is my relationship to the whole? And that's where our nature comes out. You know, there's so many aspects of the nature of the soul, just like we read about from Rupa Goswami, of all the different natures of the cowherd boys, the different natures of the gopis, the different natures of the servants. Right? Some are very quiet and shy, and some are very boisterous. And you know, they all have their own natures, their own individual natures. But it's all in relationship to the Lord. It's not that in the spiritual world, one simply is doing something that's totally according to one's nature, independent of the Lord, but one's doing something according to one's eternal, actual nature, in relationship to the Lord, in relationship to pleasing the Lord. Very much like the varnas, the occupation, should be used for the pleasure of the universal form. So our ultimate occupation should be used in the service of the Lord. Now, of course, on the spiritual level, that occupation is our real self. Our varna is not going to, it's not our real self, and therefore our varna, just as it is, will never fully satisfy us. Because it's not who we ultimately are, it's just, it's not the nature of our self, it's the nature of our vehicle, which is quite different. When we talk about swadharma in the world, even in relationship to the Lord, we're talking about, you know, do you have a Volkswagen or a Rolls Royce? Do you have an automatic or a manual? You know, that's what we're talking about. Do you have a bicycle or a car? But on the level of bhakti, we're really talking about the driver. We're talking about the real self. So in that sense, it's different. It's also different that in our original form, there's no need of a livelihood. The spiritual form does not need food and air and water and like that. It doesn't have needs for maintenance. It doesn't dwindle and die. So there's no need of a livelihood. You know, in the material world, things are arranged so that we are forced to work. And then Krishna says, okay, you're forced to work, now use it as a seva. But in our spiritual reality, there's no work. The seva that we do is the natural expression of love, of wanting to use our nature in the service of the whole. Just because that's what it is, and that's who we are, and it's so incredibly satisfying, and it's so incredibly perfect, and it's an absolute fit. You know, everything fits together in a perfect way. And then even in that bhakti, and there's degrees of purification up to, you know, total prema and up to vraja. So in all of this, the role of the guru is essential. The role of the guru is essential as to, okay, what's the nature of the vehicle you have? Okay, let's figure that out. And how can this be used? How can the nature of the vehicle you have be used in the service of the Lord? And, you know, even if you don't, as we were reading in the previous verse, even if you don't perfectly get the nature of your vehicle properly, you can't quite figure out, am I a Brahmin or a Vaishya? You know, it's not so important. Whatever you're doing, do it to please the Lord. So the guru is essential in that. Why? Because we can't figure this out on our own except in a general way. You know, we can get some kind of a societal or planetary idea that I'm part of the whole, but to really understand the universal body, you know, you're just looking up through your telescopes, you're not going to see it. You're not going to look through your telescopes and see, you know, Kshiradakshai, Vishnu, and Brahman, and so forth and so on. You need somebody to guide you. I mean, even if you want to understand the planets, you've got to have some astronomer and astrologer help you. What to speak of to understand the ultimate reality and to understand the self and how we're part of Krishna. How can we do that without guidance? We can get some idea that I'm not this body just through logic and our experience. Although it's fascinating to me that there's a big movement of Buddhism in the world today, and one of their main tenets is denial of the existence of a self. they say that really it's a moment-to-moment, our concept of a self is really a moment-to-moment thing, and all we're conscious of is our perceptions, and there is no such thing as a continuing identity. And it fascinates me that so many people who were not brought up in traditional Buddhist societies are really becoming attached to this idea of there being no self. But anyway, a little introspection and care. Amazing what philosophies Krishna can allow us to come up with. But a little bit of care sees that there isn't a continuing identity of self. It's not just that we're aware of our perceptions. We are also aware of the fact that we are perceiving our perceptions. We are aware of ourself as the perceiver. So that we can understand through our own experience and logic. But beyond that, how are we going to understand without a guru? There is a God. That's pretty simple. And God likes variety, and God's creative, and God's artistic, and God's orderly and full of surprises, so many things. But how will one understand that there is Krishna and Yasoda and Nanda Maharaj and Madhur Mangal and Lalita and Vishakha and Madhur? How will one understand all that without a guru? And not only that, but the guru shows us how. Otherwise, it becomes just some theory, right? One thing that we teach parents and teachers is don't just say, stop it. Say, what do you want them to do? And be specific. Oh, I want you to be respectful. Well, how do I do that? I was once with a teacher and her son. A teacher and her son, he was about 5 years old, and he was nagging her for some water, a glass of water, and she said, stop being rude. But she didn't tell him what to do instead, and she didn't tell him specifically. I mean, all she needed to do was model it and say, you say, may I please have a glass of water? So the guru models. The guru shows by their own behavior. The gurus show, this is how you do it. This is how you use your occupation for the pleasure of the whole. And therefore we have people like Srila Prabhupada who enter the grihastha ashram, who take an occupation, and give us Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So many throughout the Bhagavatam. This is how you do it. And on the level of awakening our eternal nature and using it in Krishna's service, this is how you do it. And this is how you do both simultaneously. This is how you offer your occupation to the Lord in the world and simultaneously awaken your real occupation and offer that to the Lord. So they give us the knowledge, the information, the gyan that's beyond our sense perception. They give us instructions on the how-to. They give us an example. And also on another platform, the guru, and this applies to all the saintly persons, they're our via medium. They introduce us to the Lord. They help us reconnect to the Lord. They're transparent in that the experience we have with the Lord is a direct experience, but it's still by their grace. The endeavor that we make according to their instructions and their example really only makes us receptive to the mercy that is already there, to the reality that we already are, to the truth that is all around us and within us and everywhere. So it really just attunes our consciousness to become receptive. And the guru specifically, as distinct from the sadhus in general, takes a personal interest in us and personally guides us and personally enrolls us in the school of bhakti. So this section of the Bhagavatam is about a healthy universal body, healthy on the sphere of society in general and on our own individual level, that we find, okay, I'm in this world, I have this body, I have this mind, I have to eat, I have to have a shelter, I have to have clothes. How do I have my livelihood in such a way that it brings me happiness and brings happiness to the Lord? And how do I have ultimate purification and realize myself? So this is all the process of bhakti as given by the spiritual master. So questions, comments?
Darshi Guru. So how would you tie all that together?
Well, part of what you said got swallowed electronically. So I think you talked about that there's three kinds of gurus.
Yes.
Right. And so all of those three kinds of gurus, there's sadhus, but there's sadhus who are directly relating with us. And particularly the Diksha Guru is the one who brings us into the Sampradaya, who officially enrolls us in the Sampradaya. The Vartma Pradakshina Guru is the one who starts us on our spiritual path. So we have a particular relationship with them over and above the sadhus in general. The sadhus in general are giving general examples and general instructions. It's something like if you have a medical condition. So nowadays, if you have a medical condition, you probably go on the internet and you do a search for what's wrong with you. But then you still need to go to a specific doctor and get a specific treatment and get a specific medicine. So, you know, you may read the studies of doctors on the internet, but how does that apply to you, and what do you do with that? For that, you need a guru. And the gurus are differentiated by their functions, who starts you on the path, who officially brings you into the Sampradaya, who instructs you, and of course, it might be one person doing two of those or one person doing all three. Is that all right?
That's nice, thank you. That was good.
Great.
I have a question if I could ask.
Sure.
I thought it was wonderful how you related that, you know, that every cell is being maintained by the body, even unconsciously. Now, if there's a cancerous cell, that's going against the good of the body, and it'll eventually be eliminated. Now, there's many statements where Srila Prabhupada has said, I looked one up, by the way, that everyone is either directly or indirectly engaged in the service of the Lord. You know, many times Prabhupada says that. So if you're a cancerous cell, you know, an atheist, just a downright demon, how are you serving the universal body of the Lord? Even without considering like that, how do we reconcile that statement? Because there are certainly people that don't want to service the Lord, so how are they indirectly serving?
Well, so let's say that there's a criminal who needs to be executed. And, you know, the normal procedure is that the criminal is arrested by the government, and the government punishes that criminal, and the government will execute that criminal. That's the general procedure. But if there's somebody who wants to commit a murder, then he can also be engaged in that task of executing the criminal. Now, of course, if the murderer executes the criminal doesn't get purified the same way that they do if the government executes them, which is interesting. You know, if you're punished by the proper agent, then you can be relieved from your sinful reactions. But in any case, they're doing the work of God. So if you're destined to lose your money, so there's so many ways that you can lose your money. I mean, so many. You can drop your wallet on the street and it gets lost. The value of your money can go down. Right, I mean, I've had an interesting experience where, you know, I'll fly to a country in Europe and they'll give me euros to pay me back for the ticket, and by the time that I actually deposit those euros, they've gone down in value, so the ticket isn't fully covered anymore. And I've had that experience several times, you know, that the value of the money goes down. So you could lose your money that way. You could lose your money by spending it on something foolish. I think we've all lost money like that. You know, we think, oh, this will be something good to buy, and you buy it, and it's terrible, and you can't return it. By the time you figure it out, it's terrible, it's not returnable anymore, and you just have to throw it away or give it away or something, you know, or it just breaks. I mean, the other day I bought a couple of the grandkids a nice toy at the mall. It's a toy I had as a kid, and it lasted for a long time, but for them it lasted for a few hours. So, you know, you can lose money that way. You can spend it on something useless. And you can lose money by somebody stealing it. That's another way you can lose your money. So if you're destined to lose your money, and someone wants to be a thief, So Krishna can engage that thief in taking the money that you're destined to lose. He doesn't require the thief. I mean, Krishna has myriad ways, as I was giving so many examples, of taking our money. You can have unexpected expenses. You can have an unexpected medical expense, an unexpected legal expense. I mean, so many ways in which we can lose money. But if that's our destiny, if that's the will of the Lord, if that's what's meant for the smooth running of the universal body to keep, because karma is basically to put everything in balance. And those who are trying to be against the will of the Lord, Krishna also uses them in his plan. Of course, they don't get credit for it. You know, if somebody's destined to lose $100 and I steal it, I don't get credit for doing something that's in Krishna's service, even though I am. Even though I'm doing something that was, I can't act outside the will of the Lord. If I want to steal money, but there's nobody around who's destined to lose money, then Krishna's not going to give me an opportunity to steal. I'll try to steal and get arrested. I'll get arrested for attempted burglary. And, you know, even if I steal money, I'm only going to steal money from people who are destined to lose it. I'm not allowed to steal something from someone who's not destined to lose it. It just won't work. I won't be able to do it. So in that way, even when I'm a demon, I'm still acting according to the will of the Lord. But the problem is, not only do I not get credit for it, but I actually get punished for it because my whole mood is against the will of the Lord. I'm not working cooperatively. You know, if I want to work cooperatively, then let me become a police officer and let me issue fines to people and I'll take their money that way and then I get a government salary. Is that clear?
Yes, that is a very good explanation I never even considered. So just to reiterate, so if somebody demoniac, whether he's raping, murdering, pillaging, he's going to suffer. But as far as the results of his activities, you know, when he hurts somebody, steals from somebody, they deserved it, and therefore he's indirectly in Krishna's service. Same if somebody's an atheist preaching atheistic philosophy. There was a need for that, and they're engaged in that way, even though they'll suffer, but Krishna,
exactly.
That needed to happen.
Exactly. Well, just like Krishna engaged Lord Shiva in preaching impersonalism, and he comes as Buddha in teaching voidism. So he doesn't require a rebellious jiva to do things like that. It can be done by himself or one of his good servants. But if you're a rebellious jiva and you want to do something, if you want to do something that's apparently harmful from our external vision, then yeah, he'll engage you in doing that. He'll give you the intelligence and the facility to do it in a way that it would have happened anyway in another way. You know, if there's a group of people destined to die, there's so many ways that they can die without an evil person being involved. You know, that's not a problem for Krishna. But if some evil person wants to kill a bunch of people, then Krishna will say, okay, these are the people that are all destined to die now, and here you go. So it's very much like that. And therefore, the devotee does not hate the perpetrator. The devotee does not name the perpetrator even, except for, you know, ordinary things of justice and society. But the devotee doesn't say, these are the people that hurt, it's these people's fault that I'm suffering. Because that's not true. That's not a devotee. If we're thinking like that, if we're speaking like that, we're not acting as devotees, at least in that moment. You know, it was this temple president who did this to me, it was this guru who did this to me, it was this... We're not in proper consciousness. That's not the reality. The reality is everything I'm doing to myself. That's the reality. And others are the agents. As Prabhupada told Peter Burwash, Peter Burwash donated thousands of dollars to the temple in Honolulu to become a life member, and the temple president and vice president took the money, deposited it in their own bank account, and left the movement with it. And when Peter complained to Prabhupada, Prabhupada said, among other things, never hate the instrument of your karma. So that doesn't excuse the other person, but that's not our business, unless I'm the government or whatever. It's not my business to take personal retribution against that person. Or then it just perpetrates the whole cycle, and then I become like the perpetrator. This person hurt me, I'm going to hurt them, and they hurt me, and I hurt them, and they hurt me. And it goes on and on and on and on and on in the realm of karma. And actually, we should feel compassion for those who are the agents of our karma, because if they're not authorized by the Lord to be the agents of our karma, if they're doing it on their own out of rebellion, then they're going to suffer, and we should have some compassion for them. And we should hope that they rectify without suffering. We should hope that they get out of the cycle and that they don't have to suffer for being the agent of our suffering.
I had to mute some people. If you need me to unmute you, just send me a text.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
But so, you mentioned right at the front end of the class that Prabhupada was asked a very interesting question. If he was to pick one verse that he wanted to communicate, he chose this Bhagavatam verse. Do you have the specific verse?
I could probably find it. Just give me a second.
That was a very interesting question to ask Prabhupada.
Yeah,
to reduce
it to one.
To one verse. Wow.
Yeah, one second.
Was that verse that all the occupations are meant ultimately for the pleasure of Krishna?
Yes.
Yes.
Atak Pumbir Vija Shrishta.
Yes.
Varnashrama Vivagasha.
Yes.
Svanastatasya Dharmas. Yes. Sang Siddhir Hari Toshan.
Yes, yes, yes. Which number is that?
I don't know. I'm not good at numbers. I just know the Sanskrit verse. I could find it. Why don't I look for it? Well, go ahead, Maharaji. Yeah. While you answer questions, I'll find it.
That's it. That's the one. I think it's the first canto, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Anyway, I couldn't find it.
I'll find it.
Thank you.
Chapter 2 on my computer.
I mean, I have the Veda base open. Okay, anybody else?
I want to see exactly how it was stated, but it mentions, let me bring this up real fast here, in the purport, Prabhupada said, oh, here it is, it says, all the conditioned souls are impure due to contact with the material nature. Don't we sometimes explain that the soul actually never becomes impure?
Yes.
Okay. So we just don't take that too literally.
Correct. It's something like, you know, if you jump in the sewer, you have sewage on top of your skin, but it's not penetrating your skin, I mean, unless it gets in your nose or mouth or something. Mm. You just wash it off. It hasn't compromised the internal body. You know, or you take a diamond and you throw it in the sewer. So you could say the diamond is now impure. And you could also say the diamond has not been affected at all. You could say both. So for practical purposes, the diamond is impure. Yeah, if you have a diamond ring and it's covered with sewage, you're not going to wear it covered with sewage. It's impure. But has the diamond ring actually become impure? I mean, according with deity worship, you know, you can offer to the deity actual jewelry even if you've worn it previously. There's that famous story of the queen who had a pearl nose ring, her own pearl nose ring, and she wanted to offer it to the deity. And she was thinking if a deity had a hole in his nose, she would offer it. And then there was this dream that she had where the deity came and said, actually, my mother pierced my nose when I was a little boy. And she offered her pearl. So it doesn't become impure, the silver, the gold, etc. At the same time, you know, it's, as I say, if it's covered with gunk, you're not going to offer it to Krishna like that. So it's basically like that we have this covering that doesn't affect the soul at all. It doesn't compromise the soul. It doesn't dirty the soul. It doesn't change. The soul is unchangeable. It doesn't change the nature of the soul. And yet, for all practical purposes, we're impure. For practical working in the world, my motives are envy, anger, you know, lust, greed. But that's not really my motives. Did you find that verse?
I did. It's in the first canto, as we thought, chapter 2, Divine and Demoniac Natures, text number 13.
Okay.
That is Sutta Goswami speaking to the sages at Namishramya.
Mahalakshmi.
Oh, no, it's not that one. It's the one that says that occupational duty should not be used for material gain. So it's not this one. It's somewhere I'm pretty sure it's somewhere in the first canto. If I can.
I don't know that verse.
You know, if you have time for one last question, Maharashtra
sure.
has a question.
Okay, sure. She says here, it says, one may be happy with brahminical service and yet have a good dose of shudra. How is that harmonized? Well, just like Prabhupada said in the previous purport, that, you know, even if we don't have perfection in our varna, just serve Krishna. I think what we have to remember is that in former ages, only people of the same varna would marry, and then they would perform samskaras to have children of a similar varna. And that's not happening anymore. So therefore, we tend to be what's called varna sankara. And varna sankara can mean an illegitimate child, but it can also mean just someone whose varna is not clear. So such tends to be the case. I haven't been able to find the quote, but Prabhupada talks about how most of us are mixed varnas in this present time. It's just kind of what it is. And just whatever you like to do, do it for Krishna. That is really... Oh, here we go. Found it. 129. 129. This is it. All occupational engagements are certainly meant for ultimate liberation. They should never be performed for material gain. Furthermore, according to sages, one who is engaged in the ultimate occupational service should never use material gain to cultivate sense gratification. Dharma siya prabhargasya narato ritta yop. Paklapate, Nartasya, Damaikantasya, Kamo, Laba, Hismitta. That's it. 129.
Interesting verse that Prabhupada
picked.
Verse.
Yeah, now of course, yeah. It could be that Srila Prabhupada picked that verse for that particular person.
Right.
So, if someone else had asked Srila Prabhupada, could you encapsulate your movement and your mission in one statement, he might have picked something else.
Right.
And I don't take that as Prabhupada's answer for everybody all the time, but I did think it significant that he gave it as an answer at least to that to that particular person in that particular circumstance.
It sort of rhymes with the early BTGs he published in India.
Mm. Mm.
He would take on global themes and how things could be corrected.
Yes. Well, for people in general, if you're going to talk about a general audience, they're absorbed in their occupational engagements. That's what they're doing. And here, all occupational engagements are for apavargasya, dharmasya apavargasya. Actually, this verse 129 is so connected to today's verse of 3634. This idea of your dharma being for purification, rather than, you know, we have artha in both verses, and of course in this verse, in 129, it's there more than once. And then it's also in 129, it's interesting that it's going to a little bit different direction, that if you're doing ultimate dharma, if you're doing your sanatan dharma, whatever material gain you get is not to be used for your sense gratification. It's to be used for the service of the Lord. So if you're doing ordinary occupations, you should do them for purification rather than sense gratification. And whatever gain comes to you, then you use that result, that fruit, in the Lord's service. So this is a model for people in general. It's sort of a template that anybody in the world, even without some advanced understanding, can follow. And if you do that, you'll get, probably gradually, purified. Okay, we have time for one more. Anybody else?
Just an interesting note that the verse that precedes the one that you're mentioning is a super famous verse. Prabhupada quotes it all the time. Dharmasansatapunsan vishakshena katasya nopadiye yediyatim shrama evahi kevalam. That the occupational activities of a man performs according to his own position, are only so much useless labor if they do not provoke attraction for the message of the personality of Godhead.
Yes, what's also fascinating about that verse, 1-8, is here we're talking about getting attracted to the Lord. Rati, we have the word rati in this verse. That there has to be rati. And if there's not rati, then it's shrama evihi kevalam. And just recently in a lecture on nectar devotion, I heard Srila Prabhupada use this verse in regard to the activities of bhakti. And it was just shocking. And Prabhupada was saying that if you do the external activities of bhakti and you never develop rati, then it's all shrama evihi kevalam. And that was like, whoa. You know, because we often talk about how it'll be slow, but it's got to get to that point. It's got to get to the point of actual attraction to the Lord. I mean, there's this other conversation I just read recently, which is another one that you go, wow. This was on a morning walk, April 24th, 76 in Melbourne. And the devotee says, often the devotee thinks that he's more unhappy than the karmis because he knows he's unhappy. And Prabhupada says, then that means he's not a devotee. The devotee says, he's not a devotee. Prabhupada says, yes, he's not devotee. Devotee means the first sign will be happy because Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma. If he's not Prasanatma, he's a rascal. He has not entered even devotional life. He's outside. That is the test. Just like Dhruva Maharaj, when he saw Vishnu, he said, everything is all right, I don't want anything. Swamim Kritarthoshmi. That is Vaishnava. And if he is still in want or unhappiness, that means he has no spiritual life at all. He is simply making a show. So, yeah. If we don't develop rati, it's all shrama evahi kevalam. It's just a waste of time. You know, of course, we're piling up agyata sukriti, so it's not a waste of time in that sense, as in karma. But we've got to come to the point. We've got to come to the point of not just working for the satisfaction of Vishnu, but actually becoming attracted to Vishnu. Yeah. And this was really a lot of the point in today's purport also, where Prabhupada talks about the impersonalist, that you have to go to the final step of loving service to the Lord with attraction to the Lord. Now, just so everybody doesn't get depressed, I mean, I don't think any of us would even have started the path of bhakti without some attraction to Krishna. So we may not be at the platform of ultimate rati, but we certainly have some rati. If we didn't, we wouldn't stay, for at least most of us. I'm sure some people stay for other reasons. But for most of us, we're engaged in Krishna consciousness because we have some attraction for Krishna. We have some attraction for his name, his qualities, his form, his leelas, his philosophy, his relationship. There's some taste there. There's some attraction. And that is the point. So thank you very much. Shrila Prabhupada Ki Jai.